call this meeting to order. I was told we have a quorum, so members must be somewhere in this room. Okay. Okay, good. So, thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Orvin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And we have Senate File 1709 before us. Senator Orvin, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be in the Health Policy Committee. I'll be honest, I think only one other occasion have I been before the Health Policy Committee, and that was in my first year, 2003. So a little nervousness on my part being back, because this is not my area of expertise. So I know I can defer to you, and I know you'll give this bill a good and fair hearing. And I want to thank my co-authors on this bill, Senators Marty, Higgins, and Senator Fischbach, for supporting this effort. Senate File 1709 is a Minnesota prescription drug program. It is intended to be a complement to the e-prescribe program that has already passed through this committee and is intended to be adopted in the state of Minnesota in 2011. Members, nearly 20 million Americans abuse prescription drugs. The number increased 80% between 2000 and 2006. The drug abuse for drugs like OxyContin continues to rise. In addition to prescription drug addiction, we also see drug diversion for recreational use because of prescription fraud. What Senate File 1709 would do is require all those that would prescribe medication in the state of Minnesota to use a tamper-resistant prescription pad. It's a special type of paper that prevents prevents fraud in the development, and the purchase of drugs with the use of that prescription form. We've met with the Department of Human Services, and we've worked on the concept of support. This would establish a new floor for prescription writing in the state of Minnesota. Right now, you have practitioners that use two different types of pads. They would use one type if there is medical assistance involved, because this is already a federal standard. Tamper-resistant pads are required on a federal level, but they are not yet required in Minnesota. So they might have a second type of prescription pad that's not tamper-resistant, and then we'll be moving to e-prescribe. So there might be three different methods by which a practitioner would then be prescribing. What this would do is say, no, if we're going to have a pad, it's just one type, and it's the tamper-resistant one that is intended to help prevent fraud in the practice. Members, this bill is intended to save the state of Minnesota approximately $15 to $30 million in the first year. There will be an upfront cost. We haven't got our fiscal note yet. There will be an upfront cost because the state will be required to provide these pads. So there will be a cost, but then there will be savings long term in public safety and in our health care system, and in the costs for insurance. I would like at this point to point out to you a letter of support from Dan Kane from RS Eden. He is a practitioner in the drug abuse community. It's a very strong statement of support, and I'm pleased to have his support. He writes that he's excited and supportive of the efforts to help prevent the kind of fraud and counterfeiting that enables those afflicted with the disease of addiction to obtain prescription drugs that are ruining lives. He says, mostly prescription pain medications taken orally accounted for 4.9% of total treatment admissions in 2007, and that was compared with 1.4% in the year 2000, so it's up substantially. Prescription drugs illicitly obtained, such as OxyContin, oxycodone, Percodan, and others, have become the drugs of choice for a growing number of substance abusers. This is costing the state money, and it's ruining lives. Members, I hope that you will support this bill. With me, I have to offer his testimony is Mr. John Harden, and he can testify about how fraud with prescription forms is costing money, and it's also causing problems with public safety and creating fraud in the system. So, Mr. Harden.
Senator Orman, before you move, I understand you have an amendment that we need to move on your behalf to put language in the shape that you wanted. Senator Erickson Ropes, if you could move the A1 amendment.
So moved.
Madam Chair, may I offer one oral amendment to Senator Erickson Ropes to add one item to the A1 amendment, please?
Yes, Senator Orman, go ahead and proceed. So let's first adopt the A1 amendment, and then we can proceed to amend the A1 amendment. So Senator Erickson,
I'll move that amendment.
It should go backwards.
We need to amend it first. Thank you. Senator Higgins, let's amend it first. Go ahead, Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a simple amendment. It would be to, on page 2, to delete Section 5, which is the rulemaking authority in the bill. There's no need to have that. It adds a huge process here that's unnecessary. We can just require the prescription forms without rulemaking authority. So I would add to the A1 amendment to, on page 2, delete Section 5.
Thank you, Senator Orman. The staff had that amendment also prepared for us. So Senator Erickson Ropes moved that Senate to adopt the A1 amendment as amended. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now to Mr. Hardin, if I may.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me introduce myself. My name is John Hardin. I represent the Standard Register Company, and my role is to work with all 50 states in sharing best practices around this issue. So I meet with different state groups, state agencies, law enforcement, and I'm also a member of the National Council on Prescription Drug Plans, where we meet to help set best practices to help fight drug diversion and abuse. And so what I'm here to do today is just share some information, but probably more importantly, answer any questions that you might have about this issue. It's to share knowledge and then try to answer questions for you. And with that, I'd also like to express my appreciation. As I study your state, the word progressive is often used. A lot of people use that word, but when I studied this state and what you're doing on e-prescribing and a lot of other fronts, this is a process that I'm very proud to be invited into because you guys are making a difference. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak today and be part of this process. What I'd like to do specifically is offer three areas of information. One, an overview, as I see it from my travels, of this issue. Then get into specifically how the criminals attack prescriptions and do the diversion. And then lastly, give you, from my point of view, the fundamentals of a well-designed program, boiled right down to three fundamentals. Does that make sense? Okay. The reason that this issue comes up is we're seeing it more and more today on TV, in the news, in print, on the web. There is a growing problem, an epidemic, as many people describe it. As I prepared for this trip, I pulled up some local stories, and I can go into them in specifics, but I'll hit a couple of the highlights. In one article, it was mentioned that 1 to 2 people a week are treated for illegal drug overdoses, including those from prescription medicines. That was for one hospital. In another article, the Minnesota Safety Council shares that accidental deaths have been increasing at an alarming rate, with poisonings, overdose of prescription and illicit drugs seeing the greatest gains. And that's consistent with what we're seeing across the country. In another study by the Minnesota Department of Health and Human Services, we learned that in just 2 counties, Hennepin and Ramsey, there were 106 opiate-related deaths in 2007 as compared to 96 deaths in those same 2 counties in 2006. So you're seeing an increase in deaths around the prescription drugs, especially opiates. And to put that into perspective, in those same 2 counties, that compares with
Mr. 70. Mr. Hardin, excuse me. Could you put the microphone closer to you? We cannot hear you.
Thank you. This compares in those same 2 counties for the same period of time with 70 cocaine-related deaths and 13 deaths involving meth. So it is kind of an unknown epidemic. It doesn't get a lot of press, but it is a growing and very serious problem. There's another side, though, that I do want to speak to. I'm going to hit some today on the cost that this program could potentially save you, and I'm going to focus specifically on the cost of the medicine, the cost of the pills leaving the pharmacy. But I think it's important to note that that is the smallest fraction, or the tip of the iceberg, if you will, of the total cost. When you get into the cost of emergency room visits, treatment for addiction, law enforcement costs, and many other costs, there's a lot that we won't cover in detail with any kind of statistics today, but I would encourage you to keep those kind of costs in mind, not to mention the enormous emotional cost to the families, friends of the addicted people that also come into play. It's already been mentioned that in 2007, more than 20 million people would abuse prescription drugs. I think an important note there is that's more than we'll abuse cocaine, heroin, hallucinogens, ecstasy, and inhalants all combined. So just to kind of put that in perspective of how much the abuse is out there. The U.S. Department of Justice calls diversion and abuse of pharmaceuticals among the leading drug threats in the country. We're seeing a shift in consumption from the illegal drugs to the legal drugs diverted illegally, if you understand the difference. And some of the reason for that is when especially our kids today look at prescription drug abuse, they think the government's approved the drug, the doctors prescribe it, the pharmacist dispense it, and my parents take it. It must be safe. In fact, most of them do not think that they can get addicted to opiates, even though it's not prescribed by a physician. So there's this perception of safety around prescription drugs. There's a recent study out just last week, and it's interesting. It corresponds with a study out of Minnesota last year. This national study just came out last week by the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and it said that in 1997, admissions for treatment for prescription painkillers for addiction to try to get off the drugs, if you will, was 1% in 1997, and last year it was 5%. So in just those few short years, we had almost a 400% increase. And last year you had a study out of your DHS department that showed admissions for other opiates, mostly prescription pain medicines taken orally, accounted for 4.9% of total treatment admissions in 2007 as compared to 1.4% in 2000. And so what I hear as I travel is a lot of budget stress on our treatment centers. They're all short-staffed, short-funded. And then when you look at the dramatic growth in admissions for prescription drug abuse, you start to see some correlations between those problems. So let me talk now. I've talked a little bit about the abuse. There's two sides to this coin, if you will. One is people are abusing drugs for recreational purposes. Some people get hooked on it because they had a car accident, some kind of pain. They started taking the medicine, and they got addicted to it. Those are very sad and emotional issues, and we should focus on them. There is another side of the coin that will frankly makes me angry, and I think makes a lot of people angry, and that's the pure for profit side of it. So I'm going to go through just a couple very quickly examples so you understand the math. If you look at hydrocodone, 7.5 milligram tablet, the pharmacy spends about 6 cents to buy it. The patient cost on a $15 copay is about 47 cents. The street value is about $5. Now, I met this morning with a nurse just coming off of an ER shift, third shift ER, and she was telling me that she sees patients literally every night, drug-seeking patients trying to get drugs that they would then sell on the street. And she shared with me that what she's being told is in this area, Vicodin goes for $25 a tablet. So what the numbers I just used were more national numbers, but just this morning it was shared with me the $25 per tablet for Vicodin. So if you look at that person using the $15 copay for that, multiply it out how much they could sell it on the street, they'd get about $160 for that prescription after spending $15. That's a 967% return. I used to say that was a lot better than I could earn on the stock market, but based on the last year, it's really a lot better than I could make on the stock market. So you can see the profit motivations. Now, that's on hydrocodone. What we're also seeing a trend in is that kind of product is diverted for the use of the abusers. There's another group out there that strictly diverts for pure profit. There was a case just last week they convicted, the Attorney General in Florida announced that they had just caught one of their most wanted lists. It was a ring of seven co-conspirators. They had defrauded Medicaid for $1.3 million through drug diversion, and they were targeting specifically HIV drugs. The reason for that is those are very expensive drugs. They're not selling them on the street. They take them back into the wholesaler behind the curtains and resell them in so that the wholesaler buys them at a cheaper price and then sells them back to the pharmacy. If you consider the cost of some of the new orphan cancer drugs that just came out last year, you're looking at a cost of $15,000 a month for prescriptions. So if I can get just one of those prescriptions counterfeited, photocopied, diverted in any way out of the system, I can make a very good living. So that's kind of the profit side of it. If you look at the cost to the country and to your state, a 2007 study done by the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud estimates that prescription drug cost, diversion cost to all insurers, that's public and private, amounted to $72.5 billion each year. If you take the percent of the national health care spend, Minnesota comes in about 1.9% of national spend. That would equate to $1.4 billion a year lost in Minnesota to the cost of supporting these drug diverters. And let me add a little bit of how that is not the cost of the pills. This insurance study looked at the total cost to insurance. And it's built on a previous study that said opiate abusers cost eight times as much per year to insure than non-abusers. An average insured life cost about $1,800 for an insurance company, but an identified opiate abuser costs that same insurance company, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, or a private insurer, about $16,000 a year. So that when you look at that $72 billion study, it's extrapolating out the total cost to the insurance company. Let me pause there if I can. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Harden.
I've got one last section. I just want to pause for questions.
Yes. Any questions from members? And Mr. Harden, we need you to wrap up because they put our agenda, a lot of bills in our agenda for this afternoon. So if you could quickly move into the final statement of your presentation.
I sure will.
Please.
I've got three quick points to make on the fundamentals of a program. If you think about a program, it should be simplified, one prescription for all prescriptions in the state. It's easier on the pharmacist. Secure those prescriptions so that only prescribers, authorized prescribers, can get access to them, and then validate them at the pharmacy. And you've got a pamphlet in front of you, and in a more detailed description, you can look at the simplify, secure, and validate section in there. So I won't go into it unless there's questions on that, if that's appropriate.
Thank you, and I think members have that information with them. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Harden, first of all, Senator Ortman, thank you for bringing the bill. It's a good bill. We've been working on some prescription issues, and I agree that prescription drug use is rampant and, out of control. I think we have overprescribed America, and it's not looking really good right now. And with this type of thing, is what you're bringing forward, is I think it's a necessary program. Mr. Harden, could you tell me a little bit about Secure Rx Solutions, what it is that company? If you did already mention it, I apologize if you already told
sure
me.
Sure thing.
That,
yeah. Actually, the company is Standard Register. Is the company that I represent. And the area that I manage for the company is.
Chair, could I ask you to
Mr.
Move
Harden,
that,
you need to
that,
talk.
Yeah,
to the microphone
here,
because we cannot hear you. Thank
sure
you.
Thing. Sorry. The company I represent is Standard Register. The division that I run is Secure Prescription Solutions. So we offer secure prescription solutions across the country. For example, in New York, we run the entire program, every prescription produced in that area. We are also a provider of secure prescriptions here in your state.
Madam Chair, Mr. Harden.
Senator Dahl.
The program, okay, so we want to go with one form. It says that we want to make sure that these aren't lost as well. So is there a program to train or put some procedures in place on how to secure these forms? It sounds like that if the forms themselves are stolen, if you don't recognize that right away, those become very valuable in themselves because now you can turn around and use those to write prescriptions.
That's
Who's going to be responsible for those kind of things, and how do you implement that type of program?
Mr. Harden, before you respond, we have way too many people talking in the audience, and we have members trying to eat their lunch, and they cannot hear. So we will appreciate if you take your conversations out to the hallway. Thank you. Please, go ahead, Mr. Harden.
That is a very astute observation. In fact, the program that we put in place in New York, one of the first things that was picked up on after the implementation of this program was the increased attention by the diverters to try to get access to these pads. And so a key component of that program is the ability to validate the prescriptions at the point of sale against a control number. And what happens is, as this product is dispensed to individual prescribers, each and every one of the prescriptions has a license plate, if you will, or a check number, if you think about your checkbook. And a checkbook, if you go out to your car this afternoon and somebody's broken into it and they've stolen your checkbook, you would immediately call the bank and put a stop payment on those checks. Nowhere other than in a secure, validatable prescription program could you put a stop payment on a prescription. So in New York and soon to be in Delaware, what they are implementing is very similar to what you're looking at doing, and that is facilitating within the paper document the ability to I think there's a stack of them coming around that can be handed out as well. The prescriber could call in, report in some fashion that would need to be set up. I lost my pads. And then those pads would be canceled within the system. If they show up at a pharmacy, that prescription would be denied. And to give you an idea of the impact of that, in one state, in the first month that they started validating those prescriptions at the pharmacy, they stopped $18 million worth of diversion just on two points. One, was the prescription number ever produced by the program, and has that number been reported lost or stolen? By the end of that first year, they had documented for Medicaid state share $140 million in savings and an estimated $72 or $75 million in private savings.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Harden, then the amount of pads that one gets a prescriber, is it that controlled so that, I mean, you don't have a year's worth of pads to work with? Because I don't know how many prescriptions might be written in a month, but if they don't get to the seventh pad and that's the one that gets pulled, I mean, if you're into diverting these things, I think you probably get pretty crafty figuring out how to break the system. But I just wonder if there's control mechanisms there so that isn't happening as well. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Hart.
Great question. I would say that would be up to your state to develop those standards. There's a lot that can be learned. What has happened in other states is you look at you make them available, and then you would understand that some prescribers write many more prescriptions in a day than other prescribers. So that would be whether you want to put limits on that or track that in any way. I think that's a good question to ask during implementation as to do you want to limit it or not. And so I'd say that's a good debate question.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, is there something in the language here that would direct what the Board of Pharmacy or someone to develop that protocol?
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, originally we had put in here rulemaking authority for the Board of Pharmacy, but that gets so complicated, especially trying to pass it at this point. But I think that it makes sense for the Board of Pharmacy, if they're going to be given this mandate, that they will be the ones distributing the prescription forms, that they would put together, you know, a protocol and how to do that. But I would certainly leave it to them, as opposed to setting it up in a statute about how many they can provide and, you know, giving that kind of information. They're certainly the experts and not me, so I would defer to them.
Okay. And
Senator
Madam
Dahl.
Chair, if I could just one last question. I thought I had one here. Obviously with the e-prescribing, then this is, they need special equipment to be able to process these particular prescription forms. So that's all part of this e-prescribing process. Is that correct? Or do they need something special in addition to what we're using for e-prescribing?
Madam Chair, great question. There's two sides that I would speak to, from the physician side and then from the pharmacist side. So from the physician side, there would be no changes. If they're using handwritten prescriptions, they would get a pad. If they are doing what I call e-print prescribing, so I'm using e-prescribing to go through the checks of formularies and adverse reactions, drug-on-drug interactions, drug-on-allergy reactions, those type of things. If it's a controlled substance, you have to print that out. So many practices now have either laser printers or thermal printers, and this type of paper can be accommodated in those printers. So they would just get a different stock to load into their printer. So no change on the prescriber side. And then on the pharmacist side, once again, there is no change. The NCPDP standards for script data electronic adjudication includes a field for a control number. So it's already in the software. The only change would be, am I scanning it in or keying it in? If I've got a scanner already, I can use it. If I don't, I can key it in. So there's no new burden in that regard for equipment or software placed on either end of the workflow.
Okay, could I bring one last question, Madam Chair?
Last question.
Mr. Harden, the forms then, now once the prescription has been filled, is there going to be some special procedures as far as disposal or anything, that those things shredded or they're kept as part, I don't know how prescriptions might be kept now after they're filled, but again, so that someone couldn't somehow get a hold of a copy for, I don't know, counterfeiting purposes. I suppose they could get them anywhere if they went into the doctor, but is there a special disposal process for those forms in these other states or that you would prescribe?
Mr. Harden.
Madam Chair, Senator Dole, what I would say first off is whatever your current statutes are, they would follow those same statutes. Is there a need to do something beyond that? In many cases today, what we're seeing are prescriptions are scanned in for archiving, and that I did not study that prior to this committee meeting, but that's kind of to reduce the storage of the paper, and hopefully there is a good process. I would encourage it to be at least an educational process to pay attention to these. Don't just throw them out in the trash, shred them. I would expect that they should be shredded anyway due to HIPAA issues. You should not allow patient data with medicine data to go out in the trash. So I think there's already a HIPAA compliance issue there that should protect that. But I think ongoing education is good. And then once it's scanned in, the only thing that we've picked up on in some of the national task forces that I've been part of, there are two types of technology, not to get too far down in the weeds, but it's something that somebody should pay attention to at some point. There are void pantographs that when you make a copy of a prescription, the word void comes up on the copy. Also, when you scan it in, so a lot of these pharmacies that are scanning them in, they get a scanned copy with that photocopy void. There are two types out there. One is a solid pantograph where the word void is solid, and it obscures the language on the prescription so that you can't read it in the archives. The other one is a hollow void. And so if you go to NCPDP standards, it's recommended as best practice for the state or for the nation to adopt the hollow standard so that the archive copy is readable. But other than that, on the paper side,
Thank you. Senator Berglund, you had a question.
Yes. First of all, Senator Ortman, I want to thank you for recognizing this problem because it is a huge problem. But then I also just want to go on to say that a couple of years ago we did pass a bill to give the Board of Pharmacy the authority to apply for federal funding to get a registry of controlled substances that would be available to providers at any 24/7 in order for them to be able to see when the last time an individual was given a controlled substances prescription and in order to avoid over-prescribing or prescribing to people who might be using them for sale. And it also allows law enforcement to have access to that so that if they are pursuing someone that is involved in illegal sale of prescription drugs on the street, that they could follow up. And we're just in the process now of getting our application in and getting that federal money so this thing can get set up. And so I just wanted people to be aware of that because, you know, we don't always remember what we did around here a year or two ago. And so sometimes we keep trying to solve the same problems over and over again in new ways. The other thing I wanted to say is that in regard to the federal stimulus money, there is no money for this. And this will have a substantial cost to the Board of Pharmacy to administer this. And, you know, the only money that came in regard to health care in general was Medicaid matching dollars, and that's all been used to offset the deficit. And so it isn't available to be spent in the Health and Human Services Committee. So I just wanted to point those two things out to you.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund. I appreciate your good counsel about this. You weren't here when I deferred to the expertise of this committee. I've only been here one other time. So these are definitely areas where you have much better information and are aware of all the things, all the efforts that are ongoing. For me, I thought this was a good program because it creates a floor for these prescriptions that we're only going to have one pad instead of two. And when we get to e-prescribe, to the extent that someone can't prescribe on that system, then they can have this one protected tamper-proof pad, and I thought that made some sense. Now, with respect to the economic stimulus funds, I think we've just asked through Senate Council for an advisory opinion on that from the Department of Health and Human Services. You may be right. There may not be any economic stimulus funds available for this. To the extent that there is, I hope that we'll pursue that. But there are other federal grant programs that might pay for this. And so hopefully if we get to the finance division, we will talk about that as a potential for financing this program. But I think that it is a good policy of the state of Minnesota. If we can get to one pad, I think that's a good policy, and I hope the members will support that effort and take this on to the next level, and we'll pursue whatever other funding options there might be. We don't yet have a fiscal note. I don't think the startup is very much from the original review. The initial review looks like it may be $100,000 or so. It's not going to be in the millions. And the anticipated savings may be in the millions. So I would just ask us to wait on the finance until we get the fiscal note. And I'm fearing with your look that you're going to tell me that it costs a lot more to upstart to initiate this. It may. I don't know.
Well, Madam Senator Chair, Ortman, the only piece of information that I have to add, Senator Ortman, is that we already do this for our public assistance programs, so there wouldn't likely be any savings to the state programs in regard to this to offset any cost of it.
Right.
Senator Ortman and Senator Berglund, you will have an opportunity to talk about this. This bill is going to be referred to the Finance Committee, so I don't know if there is Senator Hans has a question. I don't know if there is anybody in the audience. We know the director of the Board of Pharmacy is here. If he wishes to talk about something that is not related to the fiscal note attached to this, because we're really having only a presentation on the policy aspect related to that. Senator Hans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ortman, this is a very quick question. Line 2.23 of your bill, is that language necessary given that you have identical language on 2.19, 2.20? Should that be deleted? This isn't a very interesting question, but I just was trying to figure out if that meant something different than what you said in actually paragraph 5 of that.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the lines again?
Chair, yes, and Mr. Harden, I was reading through the bill, and I the language you have on line 2.18 through 2.205, and it refers to these forms have to have a thermochromatic mark on the front and back of the prescription form. And then on line 2.23, paragraph 7, you say that it has to have a thermochromatic mark on the front and the back of the prescription. It just seems like that if you set it in the one place, it's not necessary to put it in the other unless it means something different, and that's what I was trying to understand.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman,
it's a very good question. It looks like you're right, but I would defer to Senate Counsel if the reviser prepared it this way, so I'm not really sure, honestly. It looks like it's repetitive.
Yeah, I would agree, yeah.
And Madam Chair, if it's repetitive, then I would move to strike line 2.23.
Okay, Senator Hand moves to strike that language. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Okay, that amendment is adopted. Anyone else who wishes to testify? Senator Higgins moves that Senate file 1709 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The bill is adopted. Thank you, Senator
Thank
Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I won't be quite so nervous next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Senator Erickson Ropes, and this is Senate File 1154.
Not that I know of.
And members, I want to make sure that you see that we were given a very big agenda for this hour and a half that we have left in our committee. We have a committee moving into this room, so I hope that we can move fast. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Well, in that regard, we have a really simple bill. This is a housekeeping bill, technical bill, that follows some major changes and recodification of licensing with social workers from last year, the year before, and 2007. And there were just a couple little housekeeping changes that had to happen on this bill. So you see before you, a lot of it is just some minor changes in language, and I have Kate Zacherpate, I'm sorry, here to testify on the particulars if you're interested. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, and welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and
certainly
proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Zacherpate, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And I would like to first thank Senator Erickson Ropes for moving this bill today, and also to Senators Coring and Prettner-Solon for sponsoring the bill for the board. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1154, which is non-controversial and supported by stakeholder groups. The companion bill, which is House File 1366, was heard in the House Licensing Committee and was unanimously referred to Representative Thiessen's Healthcare and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee, where it's being heard yet this afternoon. As a regulatory agency, the board's mission is to provide public protection by licensing social workers, ensuring that applicants and licensees meet minimum standards for competence and ethical practice, and investigating and resolving complaints against licensed social workers in their practice. The board also provides information and education to applicants, licensees, the general public, and stakeholder groups. Senator Erickson Ropes highlighted some of the goals of this legislative proposal. It really is housekeeping in nature. It is to clarify licensing requirements, and it does not contain substantive policy changes, nor does it change the scope of practice for licensed social workers in Minnesota. In Article 3 of this bill, there is a fee reduction proposal, and I clearly understand that this committee is to hear the policy issues. Because the fee proposal is included in this bill, I just wanted to highlight for you very briefly. The board's current temporary fee decrease, which was effective January of 2006, sunsets this June 30th of 2009. Even with the current reduced fees since 2006, the board's revenues have exceeded expenditures because we have had a gradual increase in licensees, and the board has a commitment to streamlining and reducing expenditures, which the board has been successful at doing. We also have had great success with our online services. Therefore, in planning this biennial budget, the board determined it was fiscally responsible to request to maintain the current fee rates, and to request an additional 10% reduction. And this, again, the goal was to comply with the state regulations that the board must comply with to balance revenues and expenditures. The fee proposal has been approved by the governor, and it is included in the governor's budget. And I have also provided testimony before Senator Clark's committee and Senator Berglund's committee as part of the governor's budget proposal. Talking a little more specifically about the policy provisions in the bill, as Senator Erickson Ropes mentioned, this bill is really sort of a carrying through of the legislation that was passed in 2007, which Senator Erickson Ropes carried for the bill at that time as well. That bill contained increased clinical and other licensing standards, and many of those changes in 2007 included a delayed effective date, which stated that the new requirements would take effect August 1st, 2011. And that was done by the revisor's office to allow for the delayed effective date, and then the consequence of that is that the board statute was recodified in the 2007 session. The result is that we are operating with our current Board of Social Work statute, which is Minnesota Statutes 148D, and then we will be working with our recodified statute, 148E, which takes effect August 1st of 2011. So again, why is the board proposing these changes? It became apparent as we were working on the implementation of the 2007 legislation that some technical adjustments and some clarifications were needed. And in addition, the board is taking the opportunity to clean up some of our sections in our current statute, 148D. So consequently, you have a bill that appears to be rather lengthy and contains three separate articles. I want to be very clear that the core licensing requirements that were enacted in 2007 and that are in effect today are not changed. There's additional detail provided to clarify the requirement. The current requirements and the housekeeping changes must be repeated in each of the sections specific to the four different licenses that the board implements. So I'll give you just a few examples of the proposed changes. They are technical corrections. When the bill was passed in 2007 and then working through implementation, we discovered that there were, in fact, some errors in the citations and cross-references. We needed to create and clarify some definitions, and those are contained in both Articles 1 and 2, and the Attorney General's Office recommended that we include transition language, particularly for supervised practice requirements and continuing ed requirements that will be taking effect in 2011. In the supervised practice section, there's transition language proposed that clarifies that the supervised practice obtained prior to August 1st, 2011 will in fact clarify when the new requirements go into effect. There's also a slight modification to the 4,000 hours of clinical supervised practice that is required for the LICSW license. And again, that standard, which has been in effect since licensing has come into being, which is 20 years ago, is not changed. But the bill provides that now all the requirements are able to be obtained in not less than 4,000 hours and not more than 8,000 hours. There is a section in 148E specific to the LISW supervised practice requirements, which appears to be new requirements. But again, that is not the case. There is new language included. But again, what we discovered is the new language needed to be included, and it provides details of current requirements that were, in fact, missing in 148D and E. In the continuing education section, there's transition language that spells out how the increase in CE requirements will take effect. And another of these changes is that it increases the current 10 hours of independent study to 15 hours that can be earned to be more proportionate and to provide increased options for earning CE hours. And at this point, if there are any questions, I would be happy to take questions. I just have a very, very short conclusion, but I am certainly open to taking questions from the committee.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? I thought that was very good, sure. Senator Erickson-Ropes, that you bring a bill that would reduce the cost license. That's very good and very needed today. Senator Prentice-Sullivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Zacherpate, how many licensees do you have?
At Madam Chair and Senator Prentice-Sullivan, at this point in time, we have approximately 10,700, and approximately 50% of our licensees are LSWs, and about a third of our licensees are independent clinical social workers.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brennan.
I can never figure out why psychologists have the highest licensing fee. We're at $500, and you're at $45.
Madam Chair and Senator Prentice-Sullivan, I certainly will not speak to the rate of the psychology license fees. And quite frankly, it is our application fees that are $45, but our license fees for a licensed independent clinical social worker, which is the license that would be comparable to an LP, is $265 for a two-year period.
Thank you. Any other questions for the witness?
Madam
Senator,
Chair,
would you like to move your bill?
I'd like to move the bill 1154, be recommended to pass, and I'm not sure where it's going.
Do we know where this bill needs to go to the floor? Finance?
Finance.
Yeah, it has this fiscal. So Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File 1154 be recommended to pass and be referred to finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Madam
Chair.
Thank you very much,
Finance.
Members of the committee.
Yes. Finance. Now we have Senator Dahl is here. Welcome to the committee, Senator. We have Senate File 1022. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1022, and it's a very simple bill, very short, and I'll just quickly touch on the main parts of that bill, and I have at least one, maybe two people to testify on that. The Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care shall expand its volunteer ombudsman program to better meet the increasing needs of clients receiving long-term care services. The extended program must employ a full-time volunteer coordinator and include a recruitment and training process that focuses on a client dispute resolution. Currently, regional ombudsmen recruit, train, and manage volunteers. They are overloaded with cases. And a full-time volunteer coordinator position would bring in about 100 to 200 more volunteers into facilities, working with staff, administrators, and families to spot potential problems and work with them before they escalate. Every day, a greater number of individuals are living in some degree of isolation from help despite complex physical and mental health service needs. As a state, we are falling farther behind in the national rankings of ombudsman staff and volunteers. Now, I realize that we are in a budget crisis and there is a small cost, but with reductions in services for the elderly and persons with disabilities, makes the role of the volunteer ombudsman even more crucial, I believe. So I have with me a speaker here would like to testify.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deb Holtz, and I am the state ombudsman for long-term care. I also recognize that we're in a financial crisis. I also believe in miracles, so it doesn't hurt to ask. The bill in front of you attempts to develop actually a creative way to meet the demands from increasing problems faced by people receiving long-term care. The bill would garner a community core of volunteers rather than asking for more funding to staff our office with ombudsmen. We're currently ranked 47th in the nation right now in terms of ratio of ombudsman to nursing home beds. To bring that staffing up to an appropriate ratio would cost $4 million. Instead of asking for that, we're proposing that we train citizens to become certified volunteer ombudsmen with a volunteer coordinator like many other states across the nation have done. I have so many examples where I can tell you about ombudsmen making a difference in people's lives, all the way from serious issues such as physical abuse, sexual abuse, changing practices to prevent death from negligence, to something as simple as getting ice cream at night for dessert for a dying woman after her daughter called us. But I respect our limited time, so I'm going to leave you with the Albert Lee story. Everyone knows about this story in Minnesota. When the administrator learned of this tragedy, he did the right thing immediately. He did the right thing, and care providers did, absolutely. But what the families have continued to grapple with is what could we have done differently, and what will make a difference for people in the future? Would it have made a difference if there had been an ombudsman presence right there in the facility on site? Someone who could have provided an extra set of eyes and ears in a busy, understaffed setting? If only one person had had the courage to call our office and to report any concerns confidentially, we believe it might have made a difference. Our office wants people to know, family, friends, and staff, that our office is a confidential, safe haven to call. We want people to understand that so we can resolve problems together. There are many, many in the audience who actually wanted to testify in support of this bill. To respect time limits, we've limited to that to one, Care Providers of Minnesota. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Holtz. I assume you would be responding to questions, or do you have something you wish to say?
Madam Chair, I have a brief statement, if that's
please,
okay.
Please, go ahead, introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm here as the VP of Advocacy for Care Providers of Minnesota.
I'm here to testify in support of the Ombudsman Program for Long-Term Care. Today, more people are living longer with more complex needs in nursing homes. Others receive care in assisted living settings and in their own homes. The Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care is a confidential service that provides protection for seniors in these various settings. Providers know that they can work with the Ombudsman and that the confidential services make it a safe haven to call. One of the Ombudsman's key role is to work in collaboration with the consumers and the providers to find solutions. The research has demonstrated that the presence of an Ombudsman is found to favorably influence nursing home environments and the quality of care by providing a supportive climate to voice complaints and establishing a relationship with the regulators to illuminate and address issues before they escalate. It is for these reasons that we support these efforts to expand the Ombudsman program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Any questions from members? If not, Senator Coring, would you like to move the bill?
I would so make the motion.
Thank you. Senator Coring moves that Senate File 1022 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Okay, Senator Scheid, we are ready for you. Senate File 1220, Senator Scheid, welcome to the committee.
Chair, thank you. Your chairman is up in business, industry, and jobs, where I've just come from.
Members are in different committees. You know, our deadline is day after tomorrow, so everybody's trying to do their best to meet the deadlines. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1220 amends Chapter 62Q, which is statute governing health plan coverage mandates, and this particular piece of that chapter has to do with what may be used for references for what are called off-label use of drugs. Am I right about that?
Yes.
I think I understand that. So I think I take one of those off-label use of drugs. So there apparently what we do have in current law, you'll see stricken language on line 121. That what was able to be used as a reference, part of the compendia, if you will, was the United States Pharmacopoeia drug information. Well, it's not relevant anymore because it's called something else, having to do with. Why am I looking at? Anyway, I guess we're just doing. This, or do we have to do the amendment? Okay. I thought we had something else in there.
We do. No, you're right.
Okay. Madam Chair, can Ms. Almeida?
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Almeida, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Christine Almeida. I'm representing Santa Fe Aventis, and I'm working with Senator Scheid on this piece of legislation. As she mentioned, this particular section of the statute, 62Q.525, is the section that deals with off-label drug use and specifies, creates, or contains some definitions and specifies the list of standard reference compendia that are used in determining doing analysis of coverage and making some treatment decisions for cancer, for off-label use of drugs for cancer care treatment. The list, as you can see in the bill, there are some new compendia that we're adding to this section of the statute and also one that is stricken. The one that is stricken is being stricken because it is no longer in existence, and the new ones that are being added because the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have done an analysis of this and have promulgated a rule related to this, and these are the new ones that are deemed to be those that should be used. And so this is actually a nationwide effort that Sanofi is working on with the American Cancer Society and a number of other organizations to update state statutes related to listing of the proper compendia to make them comply and reflect what's occurred on the federal level. There is, I believe there is an amendment.
Madam Chair, an A1.
I'll move the amendment.
Thank you. Senator Berglund moves the, I don't have the number.
A1.
The A1 amendment. All of those, do people have the amendment?
Yes.
Sorry. Okay. All of those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Thank you. Senator, could you speak to the amendment, please, while I look for it?
I'm happy to if you want me to.
I'm sorry, did you ask? Yes, Ms. Almeida.
To the amendment, Madam Chair and members, this is language that the health plans had asked us to put in the bill to just clarify for them that that they don't need to use all of the compendia that are listed. And I really would prefer if someone from the plans is here who can get up to speak to the amendment they asked us to put on. But if there isn't anyone here to do that, that's basically what the amendment does. You can see that it adds some new language saying that they need to use the reference the compendia adopted by the health plan on an annual basis, just to clarify that not every single one of those listed needs to be used.
Thank you. We have here Ms. Comet from the health plans. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yes, this. Thank you for allowing this amendment to be added. We just wanted to be sure that with the...
Ms. Comet, we need your name.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. My name is Catherine Comet from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans.
Thank you.
This we met with the folks who were proposing these changes to update the language and statute to reflect the new compendia that are available, and we wanted to be sure that to clarify that the impact would not change anything for the health plans in terms of extra cost or additional administrative complexity, and so we just asked them to make sure that if they are going to list a number of compendia, that we be allowed to use one of them. It's my understanding the health plans have to purchase a subscription to these compendia annually, and they are expensive. And so rather than having to purchase all five, purchase the main one that is used, which is now going to be renamed as, I believe, the Thompson Micromedics Drug Dex, which I think is the main one. So that was, it really was just a technical clarification.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for the witness or for the senator? Senator Scheid, do you have a comment before we move your bill?
Madam Chair, no. I think it's pretty straightforward, and the fact that we, I think, wouldn't have to come back perhaps in the future. I mean, I think we could, but the fact that number five, Parents 5 down there says that they can follow what the United States Department of Health and Human Services comes out with from time to time, so in the future.
Thank you. Senator Hand, do you have a question?
No, Madam Chair. I just would like to, if no further questions are.
Thank you. Senator Hand moves that Senate file.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, we are not sure, but this may have a fiscal impact on our public programs, so I think we're going to have to ask for it to come to finance and request a fiscal note on it. It might not, but, you know, better be safe than sorry.
Thank you. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I certainly don't object to that. I'm guessing, however, that they probably use one already and probably have that, and one is no longer in use, one that we've stricken. It's got a new name, so they're probably already doing it, would be my guess. But I'm fine if it goes there.
Okay, so we were able to check in the time it took me to just delay this a few minutes, and so the bill it's been clarified that it would not need to go to finance.
Thank you.
Thank you. So thank Senator you. Hand moves that Senate File 1220 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The bill passes. Thank you,
Chair,
Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Olsen, we are ready for you. Senate File 1394. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Madam Chair, members, I'm pleased to be here today on Senate File 1394, and this is a bill that I think if you believe in rehabilitation of people, this is a bill that kind of walks in that direction, because as my testifier today will kind of allude to, I think people can turn their lives around and be as a real contribute to our society. And one of the things that this bill basically does is it says that the Commissioner of Public Health may set aside disqualifications. And so I have with me today Gina Evans, who would, Madam Chair, I'd like her to kind of share her story. It's a pretty compelling story, and I'd like to turn it over to her now.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee members. My name is Gina Evans, and I'm here today to ask that you would consider passing this bill. I grew up in a really dysfunctional family that was filled with alcoholism and addiction, and I took very early on at 15, fell into them same footsteps as my mother and father, and over the course of about 14 years, through my addiction, I had a couple of children, and I ended up in jail, and, you know, everything that could happen to somebody that used drugs and alcohol, that happened to me, jail, and the state of Minnesota terminated my parental rights for my children, and the reason for that wasn't because I abused them, but I dropped them off at my mom and dad's house and would leave them there for sometimes weeks at a time, and ended up going to jail and prison, and because of my incarceration, my parental rights were involuntarily terminated. And because of that, in the state of Minnesota, I can't hold any kind of license, a contractor's license, a license to work with other people in chemical dependency. I've been sober now for, it'll be 6 years in July, and I've completely changed my life around. What I do for work is I go into jails and talk about recovery and that there's hope for people in addiction through recovery. And I just want to read you something that this is a letter from my child protection worker that was involved in my CHIPS case. And she said, at no time were Ms. Snyder's actions considered dangerous to herself, her children, or others. The primary issue pertained to parental guardianship responsibilities. And then she just goes on to say that by no means would she be considered a threat to others, harm anyone, or abuse power over vulnerable citizens. You know, the reason my parental rights were involuntarily terminated is because I wasn't present at the hearing when they terminated my rights, and the reason for that was because I was in custody. And so, you know, I understand that the way that the law is written, it's written to protect people, but I just feel like if I would just be given the chance just to have the commissioner allow me the opportunity to present myself and the fact that I have been rehabilitated and that at this point in my life I actually am an asset to people in recovery and kind of a story of hope. And so I just, based on all of that, would hope that you would consider this bill. Thank you. If you guys have questions.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Thank you for coming to testify and to present your story. Do any of the members have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry, I missed your name here. It's
Ms. Evans.
Ms. Evans, what license are you seeking?
I just want to work at Minnesota Teen Challenge and be allowed to, that's the other part. I graduated from Minnesota Teen Challenge, which is a year-long treatment program, and I just would like to work in the facility, and I can't because of, I can't get DHS clearance.
Madam Chair?
Senator.
Ms. Evans has also expressed possibly going back to college and looking at being like a social worker or that's what you said, wasn't it? Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brandon-Sullivan.
As Senator Erickson-Ropes has mentioned, most chemical dependency counselors are recovering addicts or alcoholics themselves. So, but is it true then that they couldn't have any charges against them? Or what is it that causes you not to be able to be licensed?
Ms. Evans.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, is that
Solon
right?
Solon is fine.
The way that 245C, the bill is written, along with several heinous crimes like murder and child prostitution, and at the very bottom of that bill it says, regardless of the amount of time that's passed, anyone whose rights have been involuntarily terminated is also permanently disqualified. So the way that the legislation is written right now, the commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services can't even look at my case on an individual basis because it's in that subsection with permanent disbarments.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bergen.
Madam Chair, this is an area that many different senators have worked on over the years trying to make improvements in it. The last improvement we were able to make dealt with chemical dependency counselors and only allowed people who already at some time had a previous set-aside to be able to get another one so they could change jobs or be promoted. And it didn't allow anything for anybody who wants to come into the field. And well, normally I don't think doing this, you know, disqualification by disqualification is a very good idea. I mean, I think the whole law needs to be overhauled. I also know how very difficult it is to get a change in this law made, and so. So I plan to support your bill, Senator Osteen, and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Senator Berger, and I echo your comments. In fact, Senator Osteen, I'm very appreciative that you brought this to our attention, and I really would like to take on this responsibility with some members to really do a thorough review of this legislation, because we have heard testimony from many individuals who share your situation, and I think this is unfair and it's punitive. It doesn't help you move on with your life and your work, so I think this is an important piece of legislation and we need to do more of it. Any more questions for Senator Osteen or the witness? If not, Senator Pernazone.
Madam Chair, I would just move. I would move that Senate File 1394 be recommended to pass, and I'm not sure where it needs to go. Judiciary?
Needs to go to Judiciary. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to move to Senator Sharon. Welcome to the committee, Senator. We have Senate File 339.
Thank you very much. I was here with this bill just to remind the committee, and we laid it on the table with the idea that I would take the suggestion that we amend the bill to only address at this time issues related to the promulgation of rules. And so there should be amendment that
Thank you
have
Senator.
To the bill.
Do we have the amendment ready for us? We have it in our pile. Okay, it's in your pile. Thank you, Senator. Go ahead.
And it is, I'm not certain if I have the most current amendment. It's the
A3
amendment.
The A3 amendment. Members, do you have that in front of you?
Yes.
Let's move the amendment.
Senator
Pernas Solon moves the A3 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Amendment is adopted. Okay,
thank you. And I'm certainly willing to stand for any questions. This bill had a thorough hearing in front of the committee. I appreciate that the other evening. And at the end of that fairly lengthy hearing with both the health care system and the advocates of this presenting the bill, it was recommended that we eliminate all of the portions of the bill with the exception of the promulgation of rules. These are important because of the rarity of this disease process. The patients who suffer from this illness are supportive of the promulgation of the rules because it provides information for a disease process that's rare, and it helps people who are trying to provide proper treatments for that to know what reasonable regulations will be. So that's essentially what this is accomplishing.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for all the work you did on this. We know that you've taken a tremendous amount of time to come to this conclusion and present this to us. Any questions from
I'll
members?
I'll move the amendment for her.
Thank you. Senator Bergman moves the A3, the bill, because we already moved the amendment.
Oh, I'll move the bill for her. I think it still has to go to government operations.
Yes, it does.
So I'll make that motion.
Thank you. On that motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill will be referred to state and local. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, committee.
And now we have Senate File 1435, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1435, nutritionist licensure modification. This is really a housekeeping bill for the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice. Really, it does two things. It has two sections. The first section replaces the credentialing body that no longer exists with a board-approved alternative. And the second section repeals language that expired in 1996, thus eliminating any confusion over that outdated language that's been carried on the book since then. That's really all the bill does. I can tell you more about the American Board of Nutrition that no longer operates. The certification body that they chose is the Certification Board for Nutrition Specialists, and that is they offer a certification that exceeds the educational requirements listed in Minnesota statutes. It's the, you know, the new credentialing body recommended by the board. We don't know of any controversy or opposition. If any members have questions, we do have Lori Mickelson, the executive director of the State Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice, here. If there's no questions, I'd move the bill.
Thank you. Senators, any questions? It seems that this is a simple bill. Thank you. So Senator Lori moves that Senate File 1435, be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill passes. Thank you, Senator Lori.
Chair and members.
Now we have Senator Prentice-Owen. We're ready for you.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I'm going to withdraw my bill, but I would like just a few minutes to address this. And
thank you,
this
Senator.
This is not the route that I want to go. I really wanted to engage a discussion. As most of you know, rural hospitals have 16 DRGs for which they receive a bump up to 90% of what the metro area hospitals are paid for their the same services. In the governor's bill, he removes those. And this makes it very, very difficult for hospitals in greater Minnesota. And so I just want to say that I am concerned about all hospitals and providers that are in our state. And I've worked hard in the past to avoid as many cuts to hospitals as possible. And with each reduction rolled out over the past several years to our hospital community, I have become more and more concerned. Our hospitals are the backbone of the economy throughout the state, and nowhere is that more true than in greater Minnesota. Members recall that the governor has included in his budget the repeal of the provision which brings non-metropolitan hospital payments for 16 DRGs to the 90% of the metro average, and that means that non-metropolitan hospitals receive reimbursement at 90% of what their metropolitan counterparts receive for only these 16 diagnostic-related groups. And there are hundreds of others for which we receive far less than 90%. One of those DRGs is for an uncomplicated birth, and I don't mean to pick on your bill, Senator Berglund. I do support it, but the same DRG included in the freestanding birthing center bill this committee passed last week. That birthing center bill reduced the reimbursement for all hospitals to $1,650, an amount that all hospitals would agree does not cover the cost of providing the service. I will let you know that figure is closer to what some rural hospitals would receive without the 16 DRG add-on. I find it ironic that this committee would agree to one uniform statewide reimbursement for one service, while all the remaining reimbursements for services remain site-specific. And members, I will pull this bill from the agenda, but I do draw your attention to the fact that rural hospitals are also hurting, and that costs for services provided are the same as that provided in the metro area. And that often it is a real challenge for rural hospitals to make the necessary investments in facilities and staff that are due to this existing reimbursement structure. And at a minimum, I ask for your support to retain the 16 DRG provision. So, Madam Chair, I do withdraw the bill.
Thank you, Senator Bernasone. And I think that we all really share your concerns and support your efforts, especially during these tough economic times when we're going to have to make some very tough decisions related to these issues.
Thank you.
So thank you for bringing that to our attention. Senator Marty, we are ready for you.
Senate
File 1445.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm glad to see all the progress on the agenda. Senate File 1445 is a Department of Health bill, and I'll have Mr. Hindlemeyer go through the bill for us because he can do it more efficiently than I can. But we do have an A1 technical amendment to the bill, and I would move that at this time.
You have the amendment. All of those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Please go ahead and proceed with introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
I'm Tom Hindlemeyer, Director of the Health Occupations Program in the Minnesota Department of Health. And today this bill is essentially housekeeping and technical changes to occupations that we regulate. In Section 1, it concerns speech-language pathologists. We are amending one of the services describing their scope of practice so that it's consistent with the national definition. In Section 2, we are deleting a requirement to verify continuing education coursework and substituting an audit procedure. And this is similar to requirements that we have in our other occupations. Sections 3, 4, and 5 need to be read together because the net effect of the changes is zero. We are combining two separate fees into one fee, and so it's revenue neutral. The total is the same as the two separate fees together. In Section 6, we are amending a definition related to occupational therapy scope of practice. It affects occupational therapists only, and we are updating the definition to include other healthcare professionals who occupational therapists may coordinate their services with. In Section 7, we are amending another definition related to occupational therapists, and it is for the purpose of the changes we are making in Section 8, which again relate to occupational therapists. And we are putting into place some requirements for persons who delay applying for a license many years after they've completed their education and examination, so that the requirements are similar to those that we already have in the statute for persons who let their licenses lapse for quite a few years and then come back into the profession. It's about continuity of and maintenance of their skills and competencies. In Section 9, we are making some changes to the use by by occupational therapists of a practice called physical agent modalities. And we are again requiring that any coursework to use those modalities be recent. And we are allowing persons who take the coursework to begin using physical agent modalities in their practice immediately after taking the coursework under supervision while they await the commissioner's formal approval process. In Section 10, we switch occupations now to our regulation of food and beverage service establishments. The change we are making here is to allow flexible renewal dates instead of a single renewal date for everyone, which occurs annually. In Section 11, also pertaining to food and beverage establishments, we are allowing the use of decals instead of the actual paper license for posting on mobile units. In Section 12, this is related to our case mix program and the minimum data set. We are authorizing the department to use an updated set of guidelines and timelines when the federal government goes from version 2 to version 3. And it is this section in which the amendment applies. In Section 13, concerns mortuary science, and we are repealing some obsolete and redundant rules which are already in our statutes and which were overlooked in an earlier repeal of the rules. Are there any questions about any of the amendments in any of the sections?
Thank you. Any questions from members?
Madam Chair. I have a question. I just wanted someone to talk because I feel like things are going too smoothly today.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 1445 as amended to be recommended pass, and this goes.
So, Madam Chair,
Bergen.
And Senator Marty, because this has something to do with fees in it, I think it has to go to the Finance Committee. Hopefully, we can take the other provisions and at that time and move them along separately.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, yes, as you are aware, the fees are neutral. I understand if you have to
see it. But I have to have a fiscal note that says that. You know, otherwise, we'll have a lot of people coming in here telling us they got stuff that's neutral, and it might be and it might not be.
Madam Chair, that's fine. It's just taking two fees and combining them into one. The same people have to pay the same things. But so it should be, but...
It also changes how it's appropriated.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move that the bill be recommended pass referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you. On that motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. Thank you, Senator Marty. The
Madam
bill
Chair.
Will be referred to Finance. Senator Erickson Robes, Senate File 441. Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair, we're waiting for other testifiers to make their way to the table. I might believe someone is arriving just in front of the Capitol as we were getting ready to come up here.
We will proceed, and then when
I will start introducing the bill. This is a much changed bill, and I have two amendments that should be before you, the A2 amendment and the A3 amendment.
Okay.
You'll remember that last year we just had a hearing on this bill, and over the interim, we have been involved with a facilitated process between the Minnesota Hospital Association and the Minnesota Nurses Association, and they both agreed to work together and took a lot of steps towards the middle, both groups, really good outcomes. And we bring before you a bill today that is a consensus bill between the Minnesota Hospital Association and Minnesota Nurses Association. And we have taken many pieces out of the bill, and I believe that some of you may have gotten some emails yesterday or the day before having to do with the original version of the bill, not the new and improved version. And we are waiting for the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association to arrive and testify on behalf of the bill. We also have the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association here that will be testifying. But I'll just tell you briefly, we've taken out all the ratio pieces, all the numbers pieces that were making people nervous last year. And we have amended the bill to a point where we are going to be asking to track or report staffing levels when there's an adverse event.
And an adverse event is defined in statute as some grave event. It may be the wrong leg was operated on in the OR, or there's a death or a severe fall where there's sustained injury to the patient. At those points of adverse events, we are asking that the hospital, in addition to other requirements by law that they are reported or required to report, that they report the level of staffing. So that's one piece that we're doing. We are actually, maybe I should refer you to the A2 and the A3 amendment. We have been working as late as last evening and about a half an hour ago in the hallway to get to this final agreement. The A2 or the A3 amendment deletes entire Section 3, so there will be no required report. And then some other language, minor language changes, but language that the people feel will make them very comfortable. So with that, I will turn this over to Linda Slattergren, who is the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. Do you want me to adopt the amendments first?
Senator, would you like to move the amendments?
Yes, I'll do that. I would like to move them both, the A2 and the A3 amendment.
Any questions on the amendments? If not, Senator Erickson Robes moves the A2 and the A3 amendments. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendments are adopted. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll have welcome Linda Slattergren to the desk.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Linda Slattengren. I'm a registered nurse of over 30 years staff nurse experience, and I'm president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. Our association is a professional nurse union of over 21,000 registered nurses. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senator Erickson Ropes' bill, Senate File 441, and the Delete All Amendment. This amendment to report staffing as a factor in root cause analysis of adverse events before you is the result, as Senator Ropes mentioned, a compromise reached between MNA and MHA. And I am used to, as a staff nurse, a lot of quick action changes, but none that occur as fast as they do here in this Senate. So the Minnesota Nurses Association remains committed as patient advocates to working on staffing in our hospitals. As we continue to struggle to keep up with increasing patient acuity, nursing intensity, and system changes, this change, reporting staffing as a factor in root cause analysis of adverse events, is a first step forward in trying to obtain safe, quality care for our patients, a goal we all seek. As you know, hospital errors and infections account for significant costs in our healthcare system. Some of you might recall the Institute of Medicine's report about 10 years back, which reported that preventable medical errors result in an estimated 44,000 to 98,000 preventable deaths each year, at a cost estimated then to be $17 to $29 billion per year. For instance, research has shown that hospital-acquired infections, hospital complications like pressure ulcers, patient falls, bloodstream infections, and urinary tract infections are directly linked to the size and composition of the nurse staffing and assignment levels. This is a situation we are committed to rectifying. Currently, hospitals are not required to report any information regarding staffing within adverse events. We feel this is significant data that should not be overlooked in its potential for altering the quality outcomes and should be a factor in the evaluation and reporting of avoidable negative outcomes and adverse events. Registered nurses know that many of these errors and infections can be prevented with appropriate levels of patient assignments of RNs, LPNs, and assistive licensed and unlicensed personnel. This, in turn, will save patients' lives, improve quality, and reduce hospital costs. Included in this amendment is a whistleblower-type protection from investigation and discipline by the licensing board for any licensed healthcare provider who reports on an adverse event. As the hospitals did in an attempt to create a blameless system written into Minnesota law that when a facility comes forward to report an adverse event, no regulatory body, neither the Commissioner of Health nor the Office of Health Facility Complaints, shall collect data or investigate one of these events. Nurses and other licensed healthcare providers should be afforded the same protection. We will never have transparency in healthcare if nurses' professional status is jeopardized and not protected within whistleblower events. The Minnesota Nurses also supports this legislation because staffing should be a factor in the analysis of any patient adverse event. These are people, patients, humans, our citizens that we are taking care of, and as advocates, we believe the numbers of RNs that are present when these events occur should be a factor in the analysis. We know that, nurses know that when patient outcomes are better, the hospital's fiscal outcomes are positively affected. We are currently facing hard times within the hospital system. Nurses are acutely aware of that. We are sadly reporting that RNs and other healthcare staff are being laid off. We're not sure reducing direct caregivers is the answer, nor do we believe that it's the right solution. When 86% of medication errors are preventable because an RN intercepted them prior to the occurrence, reducing the number of RNs does not seem to be in the patient's or the hospital's best interests. Our members fully understand the difficult decisions ahead and appreciate your dedication, and thank you for your long hours and hard work. We understand overtime. Please support Senator Roep's amendment to Senate File 441, and we look forward to working with you on solving the staffing issues our nurses face. Thank you for hearing this.
Thank you, Mrs. Langert. Thank you. Senator, it seems like you have your other witness now.
I do, Madam Chair, and thank you to the president of Minnesota Nurses Association for testimony. I would like to reiterate to the committee, because I know people are coming and going, this bill does not contain ratios. It does not contain mandates for the hospitals to hire a particular number of nurses to patients. We have agreed on a reporting system and some nursing protection. So I just want to make that clear. And then also at your desks, I believe you have a copy of a trifold from the Hospital Association, and they request that you pull that and ignore that for the moment, right? I'm getting a nod from Sue Stout, the lobbyist for the Hospital Association. So please disregard that objection. It's not relevant anymore. And I'd like to welcome Lawrence Massa, who is the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa. I'm the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association. And I want to support the amendment that's been put in place. We've worked with Senator Erickson Roep's to try to come up with a compromise that would satisfy the Minnesota Nurses Association as well as our members in terms of putting patient safety first, working together to try to ensure that patient safety will improve in Minnesota through all of the things that we do. We think that the compromise position is workable. We support the root cause analysis process. We look at all factors when doing root cause analysis now, and we can support the language that's in the bill. And we will work with the MNA over the ensuing months to try to get on the same page as we look at implementing this bill and making it meaningful for both nurses and for our patients and for our hospital members. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Brenner-Sullivan, please.
I'm sorry, I missed your name, sir.
Lawrence Massa.
And which hospital do you represent?
I'm the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association.
I know, but which hospital do you represent?
I represent all 147 hospitals and 17 health systems.
So you're not a CEO of one of the hospitals in
that
the state?
That is correct.
Okay. How many of your members have you polled?
We've talked to a number of our members. We know that not all of our members support the compromise, but we are working with...
I haven't yet talked to a hospital that does support it. That's why I'm wondering which ones do support it.
I believe Mayo supports the proposed amendment.
Okay, I have not talked to Mayo, but I've talked to, I've heard from Abbott, Alina, Fairview, Merritt Care, St. Mary's, Detroit Lakes. I've heard from Essentia, all the Essentia hospitals, St. Luke's and Duluth. They don't support it.
Have you heard from them supporting, Madam Chair, members of the committee, have you heard from them with regard to the particular
amendment? They have seen
the amendment.
They have seen the amendment, yes.
Thank you. Senator Erickson-Rhodes.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, I believe that just even a short time ago, as a half an hour, in the hallways here, we were talking with some of the metro hospitals, and perhaps if their lobbyist is still here, or those organizations, they could step forward and testify to the point to which some of their concerns were allayed.
I would like to hear from them.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody here who wishes to present that position, please? Seems that we don't have anyone, Senator. Any questions from other members?
Okay, here we do have someone approaching.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cox. I represent Alina Hospitals and Clinics in Abbott Northwestern. We appreciate all the work that has gone into getting us to this point today. Senator Sharon Erickson-Ropes, you've been very accommodating in working with both the Minnesota Nurses Association and the Hospital Association in trying to get to a place in this language where we can all live with it. The fact is we're here today because mandated ratios was the bill that was introduced. And that makes hospitals very uncomfortable because we need some flexibility to innovate and change health care for what we're going to need to prepare for down the road. So I believe, Senator Ropes, you can speak to this as well. In the hallway a moment ago, we did talk about the A3 amendment, and that creates a level of comfort that we're willing to continue to talk about. And that creates a place for Alina today, and I'll just speak for Alina, that we can say this is a place we're willing to move forward from and continue to have conversation about. That's all I can say about it, and I can't speak for the other hospitals that you mentioned.
Thank you, Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you could speak to the fact that the adverse events reporting has worked well for the hospitals. And are you concerned at this point about this being factored in now potentially to staffing ratios?
Ms. Cox, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mark Skovic, Park Nicollet Health Services. I would concur with the comments Ms. Cox made prior to me coming up here. To Senator Solon's question, we were very deeply involved in the development of the adverse event laws, and one of the things we as hospitals were willing to do is to step forward and actually lead in this country to be totally transparent on what goes on with adverse events within our systems. There were many things we tried to accomplish with the law. We wanted to make sure it didn't try to create a blame situation, rather create a situation that we could do scientific root cause analyses that would allow us to look at what really caused the event so we can correct it for patient safety. And we weren't looking to blame anyone in that process. We were trying to understand, because typically these aren't, even where there are staff issues involved, it's not always staff that are the problem. It's the process that staff has to work with, and we try to correct those types of errors. And that's one of the things that gives us a bit of concern about dealing with any changes in the adverse event law. It's a model for the nation. It's working extremely well. We're willing to be totally transparent on it, and I hesitate anytime there's an attempt to try to amend that law.
And Madam Chair, the other concern I'm hearing is that when you first spoke about the bill, you said this is the final bill. And I'm hearing that people understood this would not be the final bill, that people would continue talking.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, in the bill you will see that there's we're asking that the commissioner convene a group of stakeholders to continue a conversation. We are going to we changed it from a work group because we don't want to get hung up in committees having to do with advisory committees and assignments and work groups, to the point where the commissioner would just consult with Minnesota Nurses Association, the Hospital Association, other stakeholder groups to define what staffing levels mean and get into some of the in-depth conversations that need to continue to happen. And we are also, I think there's something in here that's saying, says, between the Hospital Association and Nurses Association, they're going to write a letter of understanding between the two of them about some of the principles that we've agreed to now that we kept out of law that are more internal policy and rulemaking strategies rather than needing to be put into law. So there is going to be ongoing conversation, yes, Senator, about how this the bill plays out.
Thank you. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Erickson Ropes, and particularly to the Minnesota Nurses Association and the Minnesota Hospital Association. Line 3.3 to 3.7 speaks to that memorandum of understanding. Just kind of on principle, it concerns me that we feel like we need statute to require two private entities to come to the table and have discussions. So I'd be interested to hear from the Nurses Association and the Minnesota Hospital Association if their thoughts on that, and convince me that I need to implement state statute.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lynch. I'll take a stab at that first, and then I'll let you hear from the associations. That was a piece that both parties agreed to in order to be very accountable to the public and to the legislature make sure that we do move forward on this, that there can't be any attempt to just say, okay, we'll work it out, and then the parties go off to their separate corners. They wanted to let the legislature know that they've been working over the interim. They both went together to hire a facilitated process and went through all of that. They've been doing lots of work. They want this to continue, and they want to be very clear and transparent and actually have the legislature hold their feet to the fire to continue to work on this. But I'll
Ms.
let the two testifiers speak.
Madam Chair, committee. I don't think I would be here representing the nurses if we felt there was an easy course to the dialogue. I believe we feel strongly that the public needs our advocacy right now, and the conversations we've had have been successful, got kind of a roller coaster. This compromise is acceptable, but we believe that we still need sort of a hardwire driver by this committee to help us continue focusing on patient advocacy and safety.
Mr. Massa.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, it would be my goal to try to work out the memorandum of understanding with the Minnesota Nurses Association prior to this bill being presented for final passage and have that agreement so that we can do that voluntarily, as you suggest, between two private organizations without requiring legislative action on that agreement. So we've drafted a letter of understanding. We have not yet presented it to the MNA, but we would like to engage in that conversation very quickly after today's hearing.
And Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we are working on that, and if that letter is completed and agreed to by all parties, then we'll be happy to remove this, but right now it just kind of holds everybody's feet to the fire.
Thank you. Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, I guess more of a comment than anything. I agree with Senator Prettner-Solin that I have gotten many emails about the concerns about the bill, and no, they have not had the opportunity to see the compromise language, and I'm getting the impression I didn't hear overwhelming support from some of the other folks regarding the compromise language, and I'm just very uncomfortable until you've had the opportunity to really go and talk to the other hospitals and really find out how they feel about the new language, really to vote for this, to send it out of here. I'd rather see you go back to your, Mr. Massa, you go back to your members and really ask them what they think of it, because it has been, the email has been overwhelming in opposition to it.
And Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, I ask you to remember that their response and the reactions have been to last year's bill.
And Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, I understand that, but I think that they deserve the opportunity to look at the new language before we ram this through.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also would echo the concerns that have been voiced here. I've talked to people just as I was coming into the hearing that were not on board with the compromise, and I don't know the A3 amendment. That's got some level of commitment, but I'm very uncomfortable with the from the Hospital Association in particular, their commitment to this compromise. I do have a question, though, too, on the language of the bill on the Section 4, 2.33, 2.34, where you say that this, I guess it's not a work group anymore, but it's a meeting of some kind, to further define staffing levels. What does that mean? Are we contemplating here that there will be ratios established at some point, and this is the group that's going to work on that? Is that what that means? Or what is the meaning of that language?
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm, no, it is not a group to define staffing levels. It's a group that will get together to define staffing and a whole variety of complex issues. For example, if you say there's staff on the floor of a hospital, you have to determine what's the mix of the experience of those nurses. Are they LPNs, RNs, aides, that sort of thing? Then there's also acuity levels of patients that have to be taken into account, whether you have patients just being newly admitted from the ER. I mean, there's a whole level of complex questions that we have been talking about that's outside of the legislative language that they'll continue to discuss. But no, their goal is not to get to staffing ratios.
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, yeah, we just looked up 144.706.5 subdivision 8, and it is actually the root cause analysis. So it's linking it back to the root cause analysis, and what it's really saying is that, you know, enable to make the study in Section 1 of the bill work, somebody's got to talk about what staffing ratios mean and how we look at it in the terms of the root cause analysis. So on lines 234, when it's saying, for the purposes of Minnesota Statute Section 144.7065 Subdivision 8, that is the root cause analysis corrective action plan. So it's just tying the two sections together the way I understand it. Is that correct, Senator Erickson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would agree with that assessment. That the intent, as I understand it, of that portion of the bill is to have us work together to come up with guidance for our members as they perform the work on the root cause analysis on how to assess the staffing considerations and as part of that process.
I think
Senator Lurie.
I think some of our questions, because I had the same question. I was just reading it, and it wasn't clear that that's what the section was. It looked like there was a broader discussion about staffing ratios in general. And when you read the subsection, it doesn't appear that it's opening it up to a broader discussion. It's actually tying it tighter to the first section and the main intent. So it's not, it's helpful rather than expansive, would
Thank
be
you,
my
Senator.
Read.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. Any other questions? Senator Pradner-Solon.
I'm not sure that it makes it any clearer for me, I'm afraid. But let me say that I do support the need to address staffing levels for the nurses. I understand that entirely. What I do recognize is that in this economic time and with the cuts that are coming to hospitals, I'm not sure that now is the time to be able to give a very clearer, thorough discussion, because there are so many things impacting because of the economic factors that are happening right now. And I'm concerned because I'm not sure how tying it to the root cause analysis for the adverse events, that's still going to tie staffing to those situations. My concern is that staffing then will be seen as cause and effect. This accident occurred because the staffing wasn't high enough. And I'm not sure you want to put that burden on hospitals right now. I'm not saying, and that's not minimizing the whole staffing issue around the nurses.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes.
if I may. The current economic scenario that we're all in is, I believe, all the more reason to look at every potential factor that might lead to a negative patient outcome and have that addressed in the dialogue. Section 3, which we deleted, would address the economic factor, I believe, to a great extent. But truly, the time is heightened by the economic status and what that drives hospital systems to around having to make adjustments within the staffing realm. And what adjustments are positive, what adjustments are okay, what adjustments might lead to negative outcomes. This is about looking at that, dialoguing about that, and hopefully coming to some agreement around what's the safest approach for patients.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratner-Solomon.
Mr. Massa.
We supported the compromise because we already consider staffing when we do root cause analysis. And the language of the bill says that we would consider staffing among many factors in doing the root cause analysis. So we will continue to look at all factors, including staffing, which we think has been our current practice, and this supports that.
Madam Senator Pratner-Solomon.
I appreciate that, but if you already do that, then why does it need to be in statute? And why does it need to be singled out any more than bed railings are up or the floors aren't slippery or whatever the issue is?
Mr. Chair, members, I think for those of us that have been in the unfortunate experience of being in an acute care setting, it becomes very clear that the factor of the number of caregivers available to meet your needs, to provide surveillance, to do interventions in a timely fashion, become a very relevant safety factor within the healthcare environment. And right now, the staffing factor is buried under the title human factors.
We want it
brought more to the forefront.
So members, we're going to be kicked out of this room because I think Judiciary is meeting at 3. But Senator Pratner-Solomon, then Senator Lynch and Senator Dahl had a question. Please okay. Go ahead.
I'll pass for a minute while I recollect my thoughts. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could
Senator Pratner-Solomon, excuse me, Senator Erickson-Rose.
Oh, just respond real quickly to Senator Pratner-Solomon's good analysis of the overlay complications due to the economy right now. That's one of the reasons that we looked at altering the bill, because the current economy does make a lot of increased staffing expectations really unrealistic at this point. But that's why we had Section 3 in there. And Section 3 is still being carried in the House version. And this report would ask hospitals to have a conversation about teasing out those factors where they've lost staff due to the economy and due to underfunding now from the state and the federal government, and as, pull those out as they are different reasons for staffing reductions and implications on adverse events. So that report would get into all of those really thoughtful details. It's still traveling on the House side. I think it's a valid piece, but on the Senate side, people on this side, in order to agree today, wanted that taken out.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Massa, I appreciated your comment because I assume that in conducting the root cause analysis for these situations that staffing is already included in that analysis. So I appreciated your clarification there. And I would just – I tend to echo Senator Pratner-Solomon on this one in that I feel as if we're pinpointing one component of an analysis as if it were, of a higher order, if you will, than many other things. Mr. Massa, is there do we have any data to suggest that in terms of root cause analysis for these adverse events that there's a higher incidence that are results of staffing versus any number of other factors that might be?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Massa.
Senator Lynch. There is no data on to suggest that staffing is a higher cause in terms of root cause analysis. The health department and Stratus Health work with us in making those assessments, and at least to date, staffing has not been a predominant cause of adverse events, as I understand the root cause analysis process.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Carol Diemer. I'm a nursing practice specialist from Minnesota Nurses Association. Madam Chair and the committee, I think, you know, one of the issues around staffing is that we don't have the data around what is cause and effect. We have a lot of data that I think you have in your packet connecting adverse events to increased costs. There's many studies around that, but specifically on root cause analysis, I think that's why we want to get this data, because it doesn't exist in terms of specificity, but there's a lot of data, and I think we referenced about 5 studies that show there's a lot of cost savings if you prevent the adverse events, and that's really what we're trying to get at the bottom of, is what factor is staffing, and it's very complex.
Excuse me, Ms. Diemert, could you repeat your name for the record?
Carol Diemert. I'm a nurse and a nursing practice specialist for the Minnesota Nurses Association.
Thank you. Senator Bergen.
Madam Chair, you know, out of respect to Senator Rosen and her witness who's here from out of town, I suggest we either lay this bill over to the next committee or we just vote on it, one or the other, so that we don't make them have to come back from out of town.
Thank you, Senator Berger, and I really appreciate that. I was about to say that Senator Rosen has been patiently waiting. I think we are ready to vote, and I assume we should proceed with that. So, Senator Erickson-Ropes, if you could move your bill.
Yes, I'd like to move the bill as amended and ask for your support and forward it on to finance.
Thank you.
Excuse me, why does this need to go to finance?
It says in here that needs to go to the floor, Senator.
Oh, the floor. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So it will be going to the floor. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
I guess I'm in doubt. All of those in favor, please raise your hands. Did you count? Those opposed? I believe the bill passes, and it will go to the floor, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, thank you for waiting, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of this committee. I have before you Senate File 1766, and it deals with a chemical health care home pilot program. And I'd first like to thank Senator Lurie and Senator Berglund for bringing this to my attention, because they do know that chemical health is something that's near and dear to me. But basically, we need to look at the way we deliver chemical health in the state differently, in line and sync with our health care reform thought pattern. So we need to redesign the structural relationship between the counties and the state to promote greater accountability, productivity, and better results with our chemical health delivery. This pilot program would align the systemic incentives of services and payment to the appropriate level, so the right amount of chemical health care is provided in the right amount to the right person and at the right time. And it would prove a greater return on taxpayer dollars. The pilot program would create a capitated funding model for voluntary participating counties to best manage cases as they see necessary based on evidence-based practices. And the counties would negotiate with the Department of Human Services on agreements dealing with performance, governance, and services. This budget proposal is supposed to be budget neutral or could produce some cost savings. However, we would need some waivers from the state and at the federal level. And, Madam Chair, I have Mr. Kelly Harder. He's from Still County as my witness.
Thank you, Senator, and welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Also, Senator Berglund, thanks for allowing us to creating the opportunity to have the testimony today with the time frame allowed. And Senator Marty, at presentation here pretty much sums it up, and I'm not going to take more time than that other than to say we all know that the chemical health service delivery system is ripe for reform. We come to you as counties saying hold us accountable. Allow us to sit with the department. We know there's federal money and there's definitions that need to be worked through on requirements and mandates that come with that. We also know there's room for interpretation with some federal statutes, and we would like to embrace that opportunity. We are in its whole asking that we get a three-year base capitation. Give us the risk of managing that capitated model of chemical health to align it like a healthcare home, as Senator Rosen said, so we can get the right care and we can align the incentives of these dollars to the provider community to see their care and the incentive of that care with quality service and funding appropriate to that, follow the individual with realistic and legitimate outcomes. So we ask for your support. We have well over half of all the counties interested in this pilot. Well over half the population of the state of Minnesota would be positively impacted by this, we believe. So I will rest the rest of my testimony for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. Any questions? Senator Bergman.
So I know there's a lot of work left to do on this bill, but it has to go to the Finance Committee, so I would move the bill be recommended to pass and go to the Finance Committee for Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Senator Bergman. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment and thank Mr. Harder and others. The counties have been, it's nice to see you guys working on these things, and this is a key area where I think you can make a lot of progress. So thanks.
Thank you.
And thank you, Senator, for allowing us the opportunity to have this in front of you today.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, thank you very much for this hearing. And it is a great project, and I'd like to see it move forward. It does have some work that needs to be done on it, but it's a different way of thinking, but I think we can deliver chemical health in a brand new way. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. So Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 1766 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, because we're about to adjourn, I want to let committee members remind you that 12:30 on Friday we are having our last meeting pre-deadline. It's not going to be that long of a meeting. We want to make sure we get it done in a couple hours, so we'll ask people to try and be here promptly, and we'll try and move fast. Thank you very much.
With that, this committee will adjourn. Thank you.